I'm going to talk about fundamentality, in particular concern with space-time, meaning that I want to explore a little bit the possibility of space-time not being fundamental, but instead being grounded in something more fundamental and somehow emerging from that fundamental structure. This is a suggestion that seems to be made by many of the programs in quantum gravity. The way this is really made, the way in which the fundamental structure is non-spatial-temporal, differs vastly from program to program. Also, the degree to which the fundamental structure is non-spatial-temporal differs from program to program. But regardless of these differences, and which are interesting to explore in themselves, let's try to understand what the very possibility of a non-fundamental space-time could mean. Now, first of all, we will have to overcome what appears to be a very common intuition, namely that whatever there is, there has to be space-time first. So this is a sentiment expressed by Larry Sklar here some time ago when he said, what could possibly constitute a more essential, a more ineliminable component of our conceptual framework than that ordering of phenomena which places them in space and time? The spatiality and temporality of things is, we feel, the very condition of their existing at all and having other, less primordial features. A world devoid of color, smell, or taste, we could perhaps imagine. Similarly, a world stripped of what we take to be essential theoretical properties also seems conceivable to us. We could imagine a world without electric charge, without the atomic constitution of matter, perhaps without matter at all, a void, a vacuum world. But a world not in time, a world not spatial, except for some Platonists, I suppose, such a world seems devoid of real being altogether. It's a very common idea. Aristotle thought that, I mean, I'm not an expert, but I think that's what he said, that existence or material objects really are defined by existing in space and time. So if there's no space and time, it seems as if we don't really even have a grasp of what it means to physically exist, as opposed to some abstract objects existing, like, you know, in a Platonist world. Okay, now, that is a sentiment that has to be overcome if we want to take seriously the suggestion of quantum gravity programs that space-time may not, after all, be fundamental. So, but it seems, at least prima facie, that space and time are exactly the sort of thing that by necessity are fundamental, primitive, and not grounded in anything non-temporal and non-spatial. However, as I said, leading programs suggest otherwise, so I invite you today to not look at specific scientific merits of these individual programs, which are highly debatable, of course, and it's wide open, scientifically speaking. We are far from having some really good grasp on what the final theory of quantum gravity will look like. But let's not consider these merits or demerits of these different possibilities, but think about this, what it could mean. Okay, I will use an example that I've used on a number of occasions, the one of causal set theory, where I think it's a very nice theory which I can quickly introduce to you and convey the basic idea and then discuss what I want to discuss using that example. In that particular case of causal set theory, we have fundamentally a structure that's causal rather than spatiotemporal. So space-time would be grounded in causal relations, a causal structure, a structure formed by causal relations. That's the general idea. And not the other way around, as you would normally think, that there first is space-time and that whatever causation is, it's stuff doing something to one another in space-time. So we flip around the order of grounding, as it were. So the thesis then is space-time, according to quantum theories of gravity in general and according to causal set theory in particular, is not fundamental. It would be just as ordinary material objects emerge from some fundamental constituents of matter in a very analogous way. Space-time, that's my representation of space-time. This is supposed to be a block with world lines of galaxies. I hope this is, you sort of see that. Anyway, but that whole block here, maybe including the galaxies and all the matter content of these space-times, emerges from something more fundamental that's non-spatiotemporal, maybe jointly, the space-time and the matter content. Okay, that's the suggestion. So when I say that space-time is not fundamental, I mean to assert that none of the structures postulated by our most fundamental theories have what we tend to take as essential features of space and time. Now, I don't want to be an essentialist here, but if we want to assert that the fundamental structure is non-spatiotemporal, then we would like to have some criteria available, some conditions available, to judge to what extent a particular structure is non-spatial or non-temporal. So let me list just a few things which none of which, or each of which may be debatable, and each of which we may disagree about whether it really is part of what we mean when we say space or time, but each of which I think has some legitimate claim to being a real, possibly essential feature of space and time. So let's look at time first. Now, time is interesting and, of course, has suffered quite a bit by the treatment of physics over the centuries. In a way, you can read the history of physics as chopping off aspects and parts of temporal structure as the theorizing progressed. Now, for instance, here are some things that physics has eliminated already before we go to, arguably, before we go to quantum gravity. Something like a phenomenologically special moment, the now, it seems to be that's a feature of time, or of the way things are in time or relate to time. Seems very special. Now, if you know already in Newtonian mechanics and maybe even older physics, there's nothing special from the physical theoretical point of view about the now. You might also think it has a dynamical quality of flow, something that is associated with a deep fundamental aspect of becoming built into time itself. That, it seems like there's really no trace of that in physics. Moreover, there's certain tensions, of course, with relativistic physics in particular, if we want to insist that on a metaphysically fundamental flow being part of time. So far, so good. It's getting interesting when we think about, or more interesting, when we think about the direction of time. It seems that time itself may be asymmetric or have a direction. I think philosophers of physics have come to appreciate that this is one possibility, and that instead it may be that, of course, time is perfectly symmetrical in itself, and that it is rather physical processes in time which show some sort of asymmetry. So that may or may not be part of a fundamental aspect of time, but nevertheless, it seems some important aspect of time. We can go on, we can think time is a continuum where you have an order on events. This is certainly some idea you find throughout the history of philosophy, that time orders events, usually in a total ordering. That's what we would think. Of course, that structure is reduced by relativity anyway as well, but so that it's only a partial order, as there are pairs of events or processes which are not standing in a temporal precedence order. Okay, now physics has denied all of these at some point or other, I think, and that none of this is really new in quantum gravity. But things do get worse. And this is, for instance, illustrated by the problem of time in canonical quantum gravity, which is an approach to quantum gravity that starts out from general relativity, which is cast into a Hamiltonian formalism, and where you apply a so-called canonical quantization procedure to formulate a quantum version of that theory. Now, I'm not going to go into the details here, because I'm going to the details will be on the causal set theory rather, but it seems in those programs that if you accept some, it seems apparently perfectly innocuous assumptions, you seem to be forced into accepting that fundamentally there is no time, or at least no change. Now, of course, there are some assumptions here, and you can challenge that, and people have done that, and I think that's the right thing to do, but nevertheless, it's a sort of a prima facie result that sort of proceeds roughly along the following lines. You try to identify in the theory what are the genuinely physical observables, the quantities, the magnitudes that the theory tells you. These are not artifacts of the representation or the mathematics. These really capture the degrees, the physical degrees of freedom. So you try to identify those. There are certain standard ways of doing that. You get what's called a Dirac observable. And then in the particular version of quantum gravity you get here, it turns out that all these things have to commute with the Hamiltonian, which is that which generates the dynamics. And because they have to commute with the Hamiltonian, they must be constants of the motion. That is, all the physically relevant magnitudes, all those magnitudes which do represent in the theory the truly physical degrees of freedom, cannot change over time. Stuff is frozen in time. The real physical degrees of freedom are frozen in time. So it seems there cannot be change, even in the very minimal sense. I mean, forget about the dynamical flow or becoming or things like that. It's just that even that physical quantities can't have different values at different times, even in that sort of B-theoretic, at the B-theoretic level of change, there can't be such a thing. Now, that's the standard story. There are assumptions behind that, substantive assumptions, but it seems like you're facing problems like that. It seems then that the sort of the dynamical aspect of time is altogether lost if that's the case. Of course, the fact that there's no change does not imply that there's no time, but we do get certainly significantly less of a grip of what time is than we did have before. Okay, what about space? Well, what is space? Here's Henri Poincaré, who helpfully gave a definition of what physical space is. Let's look at it. He says the properties of space properly so-called. By that he means physical space as opposed to some sort of mathematical space, which can of course have all sorts of properties. But physical space properly so-called has the following aspects, which are some of the more essential. I don't know whether essentiality comes in degrees, but let's skip over that. First of all, it's continuous. Second, it's infinite. Third, it is of three dimensions. Fourth, it is homogeneous. That is to say, all its points are identical with one another. Now here, it's not identical in the sense of a metaposition. It's not numerical identity. It's something more like indiscernibility. Really, that's how you should read that. And fifth, it's isotropic, where interestingly in the English translation, the original French has been eliminated, because in the original French he explains what isotropic means. It means that through any of the points, all the straight lines are identical in the same sense again with one another. So all the directions are indiscernible. There's no distinction between the directions. Okay, good. Now, you may challenge any of these ones, but it seems like, yes, this is usually the way we conceive of physical space. We would usually think physical space has these properties, more or less. Maybe not quite all, but more or less. Here's a further list features that I want to put up to then claim that there is a problem of not just of time, which is more well known to philosophers of physics, but a problem of space just in the same way or even more radically in quantum gravitational programs. But for that I want to put some features that you would ascribe to space down. First of all, space has the structure of a differentiable manifold with a topology. It has affine structure. It has metric structure. It has a dimensionality. That seems to be sort of a standard laundry list of what it is to be physical space. Because if physical space has these features, we can do the sort of physics that we think is necessary that we can do. Whether what grounds what exactly may be a subtle and interesting question. I'm not interested in that here. Okay, so space, as it seems represented in various approaches of quantum gravity, fails to have several or all of these features. And in that sense, at least, it seems there's no space, fundamentally speaking. Okay, so that's sort of the dialectical situation that I like to get into. Here are certain things about time and space that we think normally would be part of those things. Let's look at quantum gravity programs, and my claim is that many of these things, that the fundamental structures, whatever they are, will not have many of these properties. And it is in that sense that the fundamental structure is non-spatial-temporal. And of course, because we believe generally to do old physics, to do physics as it's been established so far, we will need pretty much these structures. They have to be recovered from the fundamental structure in some appropriate way. So that is, in other words, we have to understand the emergence of space-time in quantum theories of gravity. Okay. So the basic principle of causal set theory is the idea that the fundamental structure is discrete and it consists of a partially ordered set of elementary events which are otherwise featureless. The ordering, the relation which does the ordering, is a causal relation. It's a relation of causal connectability. Maybe that's the best characterization of it. What precisely it is, it captures the causal structure of the space-times that we have in relativity theory. And it gets its main motivation from a result in general relativity, which starts with the exploration of Roger Penrose in the 1960s about causal spaces in a way that that's a notion more broad than the notion of relativistic spacetimes in GR. But that's a systematic investigation of the causal structure of these spaces has certainly started in earnest with the paper by Penrose and Kronheimer in 1967. And that gets continued into, Stephen Hawking accomplishes an important result in 1976 or maybe before, but it's published in a paper with two co-authors in 1976. And it's then improved upon by philosopher David Malamud in 1977. The theorem essentially says that given the causal structure and some additional information, one finds you can recover for the space-time everything that matters about it. You can recover the dimension, the topology, the differential structure, the metric of that manifold. Strictly speaking, this is not the statement of the theorem. What it says is that for sufficiently well-behaved, causally well-behaved space-times, that is for so-called distinguishing space-times, the causal structure is determined up to a conformal factor. That's the size information you need on top of the causal structure. So in other words, in a slogan, you could say causal structure determines geometry up to some size. Or maybe you could say causality plus volume or size equals space-time. Something like that. That's the slogan. Now, that's the inspiration for the causal set theory program. They say, isn't that interesting that, you know, with causation, a causal relation, a causal structure, you get almost everything back. Maybe that's our key to understanding what's really fundamental. So let's accept that. Now there's this other thing we need, the volume information, and in a continuum that really is something you have to add, this conformal factor. It's only termed up to the conformal factor. However, if you say that the fundamental structure is discrete, you get it sort of for free. Because the way you can then account for the size or the volume of the structure is just by counting a region. Each of these bits of that fundamental structure is supposed to represent the same chunk of volume, or give rise to the same, on average, the same volume of space-time. And in that sense, it fixes that factor. So if you have a discrete causal structure, that may be everything you need to get back relativistic space-times. Now, that is not a quantum theory yet, of course. That's just a motivation, a sort of a starting point for formulating one. And this is what motivates the approach, as I said. Okay, good. Now, it's just as an aside, let me be very brief here, but it actually, the whole program has a very, very interesting history where mathematics, physics, and philosophy, I think, are deeply intertwined. Arguably, it starts with ideas that you can find in Leibniz with a sort of a causal theory of time. It continues in Riemann's considerations about geometry. It certainly takes a serious turn with English mathematician Robb, who shows that the causal structure of Minkowski spacetime determines its topology and its metric. And then it goes on through the logical empiricists who push the causal theory of time and develop that in Reichenbach, later in Grünbaum, and then in parallel to that development, we find, as I already mentioned, mathematical physicists who think about causal structure. And then von Frassen articulates a causal theory of space-time, because, of course, at the end of the day, if we take relativity theory seriously, it seems natural to say we have to have a causal theory of space-time rather than just of time. So it's a natural move. And then with John Ehrman in 1972, it appears as all of this is brought to a stop once and for all, because Ehrman argues powerfully that there are large classes of relativistic space-times that cannot possibly be captured by a causal program because they have, in short, some causal pathologies. The causal structure is pathological. And if it is, if you have closed time-like curves and funny things like that, you should not hope to be able to recover the full space-time from the causal structure alone. So Ehrman declares the death, pretty much, of the entire program. But his PhD student, then there's this result by Hawking that I mentioned again. Maybe I should have drawn sort of parallel lines intersecting and sort of to put that, to make the connections a bit clearer. I tried to be chronological here. Anyway, Ehrman's PhD student, David Malamud, then says, well, maybe we can answer or ask a well-defined, precise question. What exactly is the level of causal pathology that has to be ruled out, or has to be non-pathology that has to be required, that gives you necessary and sufficient conditions for such a program to be successful? And this is what he answered in this theorem. He says, these are the conditions of space-time necessarily and sufficiently satisfy. If it satisfies those, then the program can work out. Anyway. Interestingly, there's also some sort of side tradition, arguably motivated by Penrose and Kronheimer, that tries to articulate precursors of the causal theory. Interestingly, in some of these papers, you find just false statements to the effect that Malamud's theorem holds without any restrictions on the causal structure and things like that. And no references to Malamud or Hawking. Anyway, there you go. So that's the sort of the story that leads up to causal set theory. We then have in 1987 Raphael Sorkin and several of his PhD students at the time who give birth to the causal set theory program, which is motivated, as I say, by that entire tradition of finding a causal theory of time or of space-time. Good. Now, what is it? Well, a bit more specifically here, the fundamental structure is a causal set, so an ordered pair of this calligraphic C, denoted by this calligraphic C, of elementary events and the relation, which I denote by this infix, I will read this as precedes, defined on C, satisfying the following conditions. It induces a partial ordering on that set. That is, it's irreflexive. I choose the irreflexive version over the reflect, the more standard reflexive one, but it doesn't make much of a difference. We can talk about that in Q&A if you're interested. But let me use that for because it's a bit more practical for what I want to do. It's anti-symmetric. That means for any two events, it's either the case that A precedes B or B. Sorry. It's not the case that A precedes B and B precedes A. So it's at most one of the two that obtains. But of course, it's a partial order. None of them may obtain. And transitivity, of course. So that's the first part. It induces a partial order. The second part is that the assumption of local finiterity, which essentially means it's a discrete structure. Between any events A and B, the set of those points which satisfy that has to be finite. The cardinality of that set is finite. So it's a discrete structure, because in a continuum, of course, that's not the case. Good. That's the basic assumption. Now, you know causal set theory, in a way. Of course, there's much more to be said about it. Just some brief remarks here. The anti-symmetry means rules out certain causal pathologies, of course. It rules out closed time-like curves, for instance. So those are sort of ab initio, ruled out. You might be worried that if GR has as models space times which contain CTCs, that this fundamental program that's supposed to give you the more fundamental structure to derive solubilistic space times may not, in fact, be able to recover those sort of space times with causal pathologies. Now, that's true. That is a concern, but I think most people in causal set theory just say, well, that's not a loss, really, because we thought in GR anyway that these kind of space-times are more sort of mathematical artifacts and not the physically relevant models of the theory anyway. Okay, discreteness, I already said that. The basal events are sort of intrinsically featureless, or at least at this point of development. They're really only identified, they are who they are, as it were, because of the position that they have in that structure. Now, you may modify causal set theory, in particular if you're concerned about the matter content of the universe, because it seems we don't live in a vacuum. Universe fundamentally want to understand how this structure, fundamental space-time structure, whatever, couples to matter, to the matter content. One way to do that is perhaps to say, well, you know, in the case of scalar fields, we could have matter content represented by scalar fields. We just slap some additional numbers on these elements, giving us the value of these fields. That's good as far as it goes. The problem is that's just scalar fields, so it seems like we can't fully represent the full material content we do want to put in the world, including vector fields and, you know, more complicated things like that. But anyway, that's an aside. Here's a causal set. You can represent this as this very beautifully simple structure containing edges that connect nodes. You're supposed to read it from the bottom to the top. So these are events which causally precede events on top of them. I do not draw any lines that are implied by transitivity, just because that would be too many lines in the diagram. Okay, now let's look at time and space in that theory. Time, first. So I said already the fundamental relation is causal, because it's motivated by the causal structure. It's supposed to be a causal connectability relation, very much in the tradition of the causal connectability relations that define relativistic space-time.
So it's not a temporal relation, it's a causal relation. The temporal relations are supposed to emerge then as aspects of the space-time that's supposed to arise from this fundamental structure. So prima facie, there's no time and causal set view. Now, that has to be tempered a little bit, because it seems like this relation looks a little bit like a temporal precedence relation, doesn't it? I said it's a causal precedence relation, but it's kind of like a temporal precedence relation, right? It certainly gives us an asymmetry. So Rolf is not here. I guess there's a fundamentally asymmetric relation here in that theory, because the anti-symmetry and the irreflexivity, of course, imply that this is an asymmetric relation. So it has built in an earlier than or later than directionality, it seems, just like maybe time does, or maybe that we would want time to have somewhere, or you know, physical processes in time to some direction coming from somewhere. There you go, there you have it. It's discrete, of course, not continuous, so that's a bit of a novelty, but maybe not too radically different, it may appear. It, of course, orders events only partially, not totally. Anybody who hoped for a total order will be disappointed by that. That's not the case. So if you look at these features, it looks a bit like a discrete version of a B-theoretic relativistic temporal precedence relation or something like that, right? Why not? We're not going to get the metric relations, the durations, but maybe we can do that by counting. How many steps up in the structures do you have to take? That's going to be each, you know, the Planck time each time as you sort of inch up that structure, something like that. Well, you might think, well, that just is time. That is what time is fundamentally in this picture. Well, I would caution against that. And let me try to push back, and then maybe we can have a discussion about it. Here's some reasons to think that maybe it's not time, or at least if whatever it is, it is significantly different. It is, again, it's discrete, so that is an important difference that actually has a very, very deep implications for the structure of the, you know, for the structure that is there. There are no metric relations, it doesn't pick an hour of flow. It gives rise to some higher dimensional structure. It's time we would normally think is one dimensional. This thing has more complicated dimensionality properties than being a one dimensional time. Let me try to explain that just briefly. Now the problem is that standard definitions of what it is to be a dimension work very well in continuum spaces and have to be sort of adapted to discrete spaces, in particular if you're worried that the dimensionality that you attribute to the discrete spaces on the basis of their intrinsic properties should match the dimensionality of the space-time that emerges from these. So for generic, sufficiently well-behaved causal sets, you would want to look at the discrete fundamental structure and read off and say, ha, the dimensionality is 4. And then show, of course, that it gives rise to something like the Minkowski space time, or eventually Minkowski space time. That would be the hope. So how could you do that? Well, you could define, as Meyer did in his PhD, the so-called Minkowski dimension of a causal set, which is the dimension of the lowest dimensional Minkowski space into which it can be embedded. So you can embed the discrete structure into Minkowski space time, of course. How do you do that? Well, an embedding has to satisfy certain conditions. Most importantly, it has to satisfy the condition that it preserves the causal structure. So the embedding of a causal set into a relativistic spacetime, MG, is an injective map from the domain of the causal set into the manifold that preserves the causal structure so that for any two points in two elements of the causal set, if X precedes Y, and I'm sorry, here I now use the reflexive version, but that's not that important. If X precedes Y, or X precedes Y just in case the image of X is in the causal past of the image of Y. That seems natural enough. Otherwise, we haven't done the embedding properly.
Of course, otherwise you could just take all points in the causal set, squeeze them, and map them into the unit interval of the real numbers or something like that. That would not be a useful mapping at all. The mapping, the embedding, is supposed to show you how this relates to the emerging space-time structure. So therefore, of course, the causal structure has to be preserved. Now, that gives you a constraint of what dimensionality the Minkowski space into which this can be mapped at least has to have. And it will turn out that that dimension n of the Minkowski spacetime that you need to map this, to do this embedding, in general is much larger than 1. Unfortunately, often also much larger than 4. So that is a bit of a point that needs some attention. Okay. So the dimensionality is certainly a richer problem here. Something more seems to be going on. In a way, the reason, of course, is that this is not just time. It is that relation which gives rise to space-time, not just time. And in that sense, it's different from just time. Okay. And of course, as I said, there's a very, very clear and, I believe, clean history, sort of historical thread, that shows that it's related to the causal structure, not so much the temporal structure of relativistic space-times. Okay. Which in a way is not, I think it's reasonable to interpret relativistic space-time already as putting the causal structure at the center and, you know, understanding spatial and temporal structure by themselves as sort of derivative on the geometry of the four-dimensional thing. Okay, well, anyway, but I'm not going to further elaborate that. Let's look at space because I have a few more minutes. Okay, but let's look at space. That's an interesting case. Now, what is space? Well, let's look at the causal set and see how we can have relations, spatially related events to one another. Start from any random event in a causal set structure. I picked one at random. This is the here now, I suppose. Something like that. I mean, here now, it's a bit problematic because I told you there's not really a spatial-temporal structure, but something. Pick one event like that and try to determine which of these other events, together with this event, constituting something like space. Well, one thing I think that we can rule out are those events which causally precede the red one or are causally preceded by the red one. That should not be sort of spatially related to that event, right? I hope you agree with that. So that gives us still all the green points here. All the green points do not causally precede or are not causally preceded by the red point. Now that seems to be a little bit too much. We need to rule out some more because if you look over here, for instance, we have maybe several sequences of subsets of that set of green points where we have causal relations obtaining between distinct events. And that seems a little bit strange if they are supposed to be spatially related, because presumably being spatially related is something like an equivalence relation. If this point is spatially related to that, and that point is spatially related to that, then these two should also be spatially related to one another. And if that's the case, so that actually that's a bad example because these two probably are, but what about these two? Right? They should not be spatially related. So let's try to find a maximal subset of those green points such that no pair of green points stand in a causal precedence relation. That seems the reasonable thing to do to try and identify what space. So we look at a set of all space-like related events to some randomly picked event, the red one, which are then the events that do not causally precede or causally preceded by the here now. Sorry, I just said that. you may then define space as judged from one reference point to be the set, the maximal set of events in C, which contain that point that you randomly picked, so in a way that no two elements are causally related. Now, of course, in general, this set will be highly non-unique, because, I mean, I didn't. But if you look at the green points, so I could choose all points which are sort of represented here in the same level or same generation of points, right? But I could also pick all of those and then this one down here. That would not work, sorry. But what about this one and these here? So it's generally highly non-unique, of course. But then again, that's not disconcerting, because if you think about relativistic space-time, you try to come up with sort of hyper space-like hypersurfaces or something like that, that's highly non-unique. You generally get many, many different ways of saying that which points are spatially related to one point, one particular event. So that's not the problem. The problem is, however, that the resulting subset of events in C is completely structureless, fundamentally, because I just told you it's defined so that it's a maximal set of events which are not causally related. The causal relation is the only relation that's present there, fundamentally speaking. So it's completely structureless. And therefore, it has none of the structures that we said space has. No affine structure, metric structure, topological structure, whatever you want. It has none of that, because by definition, all structure is ruled out. So we have a problem of space. It has itself certainly no dimensions. The usual dimension estimators, there are other dimensional estimators, not just the Minkowski space dimension that I defined. There are other ones that you can define. Anyway, because we don't have causal chains at all, they're all going to give us, this is a dimension zero set. That's not going to come out the right way. There's no affine or differentiable structure. Except perhaps in a trivial way that the structureless point can be considered a zero-dimensional affine space or something like that. But that's not really clearly not enough for the kind of physics that we want, or we would normally think space, structure space should have to do the normal kind of physics. It has no metrical structure. There's nothing that could support distance relations or something like that in that set. So what's going on? Well, what's going on is that space will be some aspect, of course, of the total four-dimensional space-time that arises from or emerges from that total causal set. And only sort of in this indirect way can you then read out properties of space. There's no way you can sort of identify a subset of elements in the causal set and sort of read off the spatial structure of that. You have to look at the whole causal set, relate that to a Minkowski space-time or some relativistic space-time, and then study the spatial geometry perhaps that's induced in this way. So it seems there's certainly no space in the usual sense. Now anyway, this is just one way in which these fundamental structures are non-temporal, non-spatial. And this is a purely classical theory. This is certainly not going to be an adequate theory for quantum gravity. However, do not sort of keep your hopes up for if we go quantum that things will become any prettier. That's not going to be the case. And if anything, quantum effects will complicate that picture, and it will be much more difficult to read out any of the usual relativistic spatial and temporal structures that we want from the fundamental thing. But anyway, I mean, that would be more talk. I warmly recommend that you go and read the book I'm currently writing with Nick Huggett on that topic, which hopefully will see the light of day, one day, But that's supposed to be the sort of the bigger project there, that we look at various approaches to quantum gravity. We try to show how the fundamental structure differs radically from space-time, or different space-times, and how it can nevertheless be related to, or give rise to, or have something like relativistic space-times emerge from that fundamental structure. Because, of course, that we have to get. Because any such fundamental theory that wants to replace general relativity has to explain why general relativity is such a successful theory, so empirically adequate, in those cases where it is empirically adequate, where it was successful. So that has to be a task. Good. Anyway, by way of conclusion, if it makes you feel sleep better, call this fundamental thing, whatever it's going to be, space-time. I'm not going to quibble about words, but do so by remaining fully awake to the fact that this structure that you now decide to call space-time is really radically different from the space-time we know and love from old physics. Look, in a way, I think using the term space-time may well be justified, because it is, in a way, a scientific discovery, perhaps, then, that would say, oh, this is what space-time really is. We learned the deeper structure of space-time, which turned out to be radically different from what we thought it was going to be, but it's something scientists found out about the fundamental structure of space-time. So, of course, it's space-time. Fair enough. That's certainly justified use of terms in this way. Okay, yeah, I think I already said that, and with that, I would like to thank you for your attention.